When we came in, at about 10:30 at night, the battle started raging. Right at the entrance to the Golden Temple, the entire fortress was fortified.
In 1984, the holy shrine of the Sikhs, the Golden Temple in Amritsar, was stormed by the Indian army and police. Inside were militants fighting for a separate Sikh state, Khalistan.
The battle of the Golden Temple has been hard-fought and costly and may not be over yet. Reports have already started coming in of violent protests by Sikhs against the attack on their most sacred shrine.
Operation Blue Star, as it was known, shook the Sikh community around the world. It was a daring move which the Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi paid for dearly. In October 1984, she was assassinated by her two Sikh bodyguards, sparking off some of the worst rioting seen between the Hindus and the Sikhs since the partition. Punjab was caught up in a vicious period of militancy. More than 21,000 people were killed and thousands more have disappeared.
We have a special room just for the cases on the Punjab, if I may take you upstairs.
In between working shifts at a London hospital, Dr. Jasdev Rai began spending much of his spare time helping those fleeing the violence.
We've had cases from 85 onwards, detention and torture. This is an involuntary disappearance, you see. And this is only the tip of the iceberg, really. These are just cases that went to court at a time when people were very scared.
What he saw affected him deeply.
I was happily making my career as a surgeon when I was approached by a few asylum seekers asking for medical advice, and I was quite moved. Yeah, I still remember those days. You know, the torture and things like that. As a doctor, I had this dilemma before me, that you can accept natural diseases, injuries and diseases resulting from human torture and activity. This can surely be stopped.
He set up the Sikh Human Rights Group, and one of the first people he helped was Jagwinder Singh. In 1984, Jagwinder was living in Punjab and was horrified by the storming of the Sikh's holy shrine and the spillage of blood. His reaction was to send his Prime Minister, Indira Gandhi, a telegram.
They wrote that whatever you have done in Punjab was like a satanic act. You shouldn't have done that to your own people in your own country. And that was probably unacceptable to the Indian government, and the telegram was passed on to the army officer who was in charge of our city, and that army officer ordered the local police to arrest me, and I was arrested the very next day.
Jagwinder Singh was charged with civil disturbance and jailed for a month. However, as a practicing Sikh, police suspected him of supporting militants and agitating for a separate Khalistan. He was arrested again and remanded to an interrogation centre for 6 months. Whilst he was there, he was tortured.
What happened in our case, they had a steel log of the Indian steam engine piston. That's what they used to roll on the back of our legs, and they used to hang us upside down. The horrific way was they used to come at midnight and they will take you out of the cells and they will start beating you, kicking you, and they will fill in the red chilies through your anus and all that stuff that we went through. That was horrible. That's why I say it was worth to die than to live for the next day.
Eventually, he was charged under the National Security Act. He was later acquitted, but on his way home, he was picked up again. This time, he was luckier. After a week, his father negotiated his release and Jagwinder went to the UK, where he joined his wife. But for the Singh family, this was only the beginning. We've been driving now for about 6 hours, from Delhi to the northwest of India, to Punjab. It's one of the more prosperous states, and it's known as the country's breadbasket. During the decade of violence, many young Sikh men disappeared from the towns and villages dotted across the state. We're on our way to meet Jagwinder's parents in southern Punjab, in Sangrur. Jagwinder's family live in a typical village house. As you enter, you step into a red brick courtyard with cattle at the far end. It's home to Jagwinder's parents and the wife and children of his younger brother, Tejinder. Tejinder Singh is one of Punjab's disappeared, last seen by his father, Bud, in 1993.
Pehli hua ji, The police arrived in the middle of the night and we were woken up and someone came through the window. We were scared and frightened and we were shaking with fear. We were blindfolded and bundled into a police jeep. They took us to the police station and they locked us up. I could hear my son crying out, and at that point I could tell they were going to be brutal to him, and they obviously were hurting him in some way, and I could hear him screaming more and more, and my heart was just broken because I couldn't do anything to stop this. I couldn't prevent this, and I was his father. After an hour of hearing my son scream, they came and took me to this room where they were obviously committing atrocities. I could see my son's clothing, I could see his trousers and his shirt, and I could also see his turban, which had been undone, but I couldn't see him anywhere. There was a big fat stick, and I thought they must have beaten him with that, and I wasn't sure what had happened to him.
Bud Singh was released 4 days later, after he was badly beaten. He was never charged with any offence. The family tried to get Tejinder released, but instead Bud Singh was picked up again and saw his son for the last time.
I was in a cell next door to him. I couldn't see him at first, but when I did, they wouldn't let me meet him. In the police station, you're not allowed to talk, so I couldn't speak to him. I saw him in the evening when I was escorted to the bathroom and I had to go past his room, but I couldn't say anything to him.
Bud Singh was released without charge, dumped late at night from a jeep onto a roadside. He was blindfolded with his hands tied behind his back. Later, an investigation carried out by India's elite police service, the Central Bureau of Investigation, or CBI, concluded Tejinder had been taken to Calcutta, where he was asked to act as a police informer. It's never been established if Tejinder is alive or dead. A local superintendent has been charged with illegal detention and abduction. He denies the charges. Back in northern Punjab, in Amritsar, some clues as to what happened to the disappeared started to emerge in the mid-1990s.
For a very long time, I really could not figure out how such a large number of people could disappear in Punjab, and there was no trace of them whatsoever. And slowly, I sort of realized that basically there is evidence lying around and we've just not looked at the right place.
Jaspal Dhillon is a human rights activist with the Sikh political party. He's convinced that during the early 80s to the early 90s, many young Sikh men were killed after being illegally detained by the police. Dhillon's investigations led him here, to Dugyandar Mandir, a cremation ground in the centre of Amritsar, close by to the Golden Temple. The grounds are not very large and are enclosed by a red brick wall. Inside the square are 13 raised platforms, about 6 inches from the ground. On some are ashes, waiting to be collected by relatives. Dhillon and his colleagues believe that it was here and other cremation grounds in Punjab that bodies were disposed of, burnt secretly by police. A belief confirmed when they persuaded a crematorium clerk to let them look at the records.
Most of the cremations take place in the afternoon. We had gone in the morning when there was very little activity there and a very, very junior clerk was present over there. And we managed to get this clerk to show us his records. And while I was looking at the records, I very casually asked him if there was any other record they maintained. What about the dead bodies brought in by the police? And he very clearly stated, no, we have a completely different register for those bodies. Then he went inside and he got this separate register. And on this register, it was titled Unclaimed Unidentified Bodies. And there was the serial number, the date, number of bodies, name of body, address of body, father's name, the initials of the officer who brought it in, money paid for the coffin cloth, and everything was initialed. And we were quite amazed to see this whole record they had. While I kept on talking to this clerk who was showing me this register, I managed to slip this register off to one of my friends who went down into the outside into the market and he photocopied the whole thing.
The team looked at the records of three cremation grounds in Amritsar. They contained a wealth of detail, even down to how much firewood the police had paid for funeral pyres. Some bodies were unidentified, but others were named, and they began tracking down parents like Baldev Singh, whose son Bhagat disappeared after the police came for him late one evening in
1990.
The police came up to the house making a lot of noise, demanding the door be opened. They dragged me outside and put me against the car. They wanted to know where my son was. He was so scared with all the commotion he ran away over the rooftop of our house and managed to get away. They tied me up, blindfolded me and took me to the police station and beat me very badly and tortured me as well. They were just asking the same question every day. Where is your son?
Baldev Singh was released after 3 or 4 days. His son Bhagat did not come home again. But 2 years later, he was arrested on suspicion of being involved with the militants. It was shortly after that his father, Baldev, read a newspaper article about a militant who'd been killed in what was described as an encounter with the police. Despite police denials, Baldev was sure the young man killed was his son.
We rushed to the cremation ground and could see a pyre already burning. We asked the person in charge who was being burned, and he told us it was Bhagat Singh, our son. I could see his head lying one end and his legs the other end, and the logs that were on top of his body. I took them off, and then I saw one of his arms and his hand, and I could see they were my son's hands. I could see my son's feet, and at that point I knew it was him. I could see the side of his chest. There were bullet holes, at least 2, 3, or 4 bullet holes from each side. That was more than I could bear to see. His face was already being lit by the flames, so there was nothing I could do. So I organised the funeral ceremony.
This was a breakthrough for the human rights lobbyists. They believe there's a direct link between the young Sikh man who disappeared and the bodies disposed of by the police in the cremation grounds. At the three sites in Amritsar, investigators discovered that 2,097 bodies had been burnt by the police. Of these, just 585 have been identified. And this year, for the first time, the Punjab government published official affidavits setting out the circumstances in which they were killed. It's a development seized upon by the human rights lawyer Ashok Agarwal.
They contain some very minimal information about how they say they came across the body or how they happened to kill the body. And then paragraph 30 is again common to most of the affidavits that they have filed, simply saying that the police handed over the dead body to the municipal corporation and the cremation was done with full respect.
The police would actually argue that many of them were terrorists, many of them were militants.
They're talking about the threats that the terrorist groups used to hold out. Yes, that is true. I'm not saying that there was no terrorism in Punjab or that... What we're talking about is how you deal with such a situation. How does a legitimate, constitutionally elected and constituted state deal with such a situation? If they were terrorists, then they had to be dealt with in accordance with the law. The Punjab had enough powers to deal with these people. They were people who had committed criminal acts. They should have been dealt with.
Claims that the bodies burnt in secret cremations were victims of extrajudicial killings by the police, often in staged encounters, are vigorously denied. KPS Gill was one of the police chiefs of Punjab during the militancy period. He says that these were militants killed in legitimate operations. And for him, there's a simple explanation for the secrecy surrounding the cremations. He didn't want them turned into martyrs.
It was the policy that, look, do not allow cremations, which are public occasions where thousands collect, because every such cremation, and these fellows will make fiery speeches and disappear from the scene, will create 10 more youngsters as cannon fodder for their politics. So we said, let no one attend these cremations. Then the people informed that, look, the cremation has taken place. I'll give you an instance, a graphic instance. On one occasion, a terrorist was killed, was cremated, as the family wanted to have a massive bhog ceremony, a public. We said, nothing doing. They kidnapped 66 policemen and their family members. And they said, if you don't allow bhog ceremony, we'll kill these fellows. We didn't allow it. They killed 66 people in one night. know, so it was not a game. It was not something light-hearted. There was something very serious going on in Punjab. And there were very serious consideration for the life and existence of the ordinary citizens of this country.
Some of the human rights groups have put forward another reason for why the bodies weren't given back. They say that these men were men who were picked up by the police and were illegally being detained.
No, no. As I told you, 10 years this investigation has gone on. It can go on for another 100 years. Let them prove these things.
There were also some allegations which were made that some of those who were killed by police weren't actually killed in battles, but they were actually killed in stage-managed encounters.
I mean, I have to come back that 10 years these investigations have gone on. None of these allegations have been proved till now. So what does one do?
But trying to investigate these allegations has been difficult and dangerous for human rights lawyers. Some of the campaigners have received death threats. Others have disappeared, like Jaswant Singh Kalra. He's been working with Jaspal Dhillon on the investigations into Amritsar's cremation grounds when he suspected he was being followed.
I felt that he was very uncomfortable and he was very shaky, he was very jittery. And when I asked him, he said that he feels that he's being shadowed, he's being followed, and he's scared for himself and his family. And he then told me that he is going to ask his wife to take leave from the job she was doing as an assistant librarian in the university, and he would pick up his children from school and take a vacation for 3 months, and he would come away. And that was the last conversation I had with him. 3 or 4 days later, he was disappeared, and that's it.
I knew what he was doing and I was slightly worried, but he was very bold and he thought he was doing the right thing. He had the facts and figures, he had it in black and white, on paper. But we also knew what was going on, the fact all these cremations were taking place. We'd heard all the stories, so-and-so was being burned, or various unknown bodies were being burned.
Paramjit Kalra and her two children still live in Amritsar. She hasn't seen her husband Jaswant since the day he went missing in 1995.
I'd only been at work for 10 or 15 minutes when a message was left for me that I should come home immediately, which I thought was quite odd. I knew my husband was okay. I just left him. He was on his way with a colleague to a newspaper and already had the car out in the drive. He was cleaning it up, ready to go. It's only a 10-minute walk back home, but on my way I met Rajiv Singh, his colleague, and he told me the police had taken my husband and he'd made a note of the car registration number.
Police denied plainclothes officers had taken Mr. Kalra or that they were holding him, but 15 months later 9 officers were formally charged with his abduction. All deny the allegations. As the case continues, one of the witnesses is under police protection. Another was awarded 50,000 rupees in compensation after the police wrongfully arrested him. And Mrs. Kalra herself accuses the police of attempting to intimidate her while she waits the outcome.
We've been harassed many times. Once I was arrested. The intelligence service was on the corner of the street. They keep a watch on us, watching who's coming and who's going, noting car registration numbers. I'm sure they even listen to our phone calls. I'm also very fearful for my children. They just go from home to school and nothing else. I'm very aware that there's just 3 of us in this house, and I always worry for them.
It's not just the local human rights workers who are being hampered. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have been denied visas to travel to Punjab and carry out their own inquiries. And even when the Indian Supreme Court ordered the country's own National Human Rights Commission, or the NHRC, to investigate the allegations of illegal cremations, it limited the scope of the inquiry to just 3 districts in Amritsar, to the frustration of lawyer Ashok Agarwal.
We did not say that cremations was the only method of disposal. In fact, we said categorically that many bodies were disposed of in the canals. So we made it very clear that there was the need for a comprehensive investigation. into all matters of human rights violation, disappearances, extrajudicial killings. This was our position before the commission also. And I see no reason why the commission, as I said, in law there is no basis absolutely for distinguishing between cremations and disposals in other manners. And it's no basis for distinguishing between people cremated in Amritsar or elsewhere. I see no political will in the country to alleviate the human rights situation. 8 years have passed. We have made very little real progress. I would have said that within the first year itself, the Punjab government should have come out with its stand. Now, 7 years later, this is still not over.
Human rights investigators have also been in cases where individual police officers have been accused. Navkiran Singh is a lawyer who represents the families of those who've disappeared. He claims that an attempt has been made on his own life, but he's particularly concerned that so few officers have been convicted.
Around 400 police officials were booked. But ultimately, when we make an analysis of what happened, we reach to a conclusion that it was all a false hope. Like the police officials who were charged of criminal charges like murder, they are appearing in the court as accused, but they are on active duty. And then the whole process of trying them in the trial courts is so tardy, it's so lengthy, that ultimately witnesses, they succumb to pressures, and there are threats also. So by the end of the day, when today we look back what we were able to do, it's not even 2% of the cases where we could get convictions out of those police officials.
The police say that this isn't surprising. It's now so long since these incidents happened that it's difficult to gather reliable evidence. Assistant Director General of Punjab Police, AP Bhatnagar, admits that a small number of officers may be guilty, but it's time to leave the past behind.
The point is this, that there was utter confusion and anarchy. And it was only police as an institution was able to confront the situation. Now, under this situation, there is sometimes this tendency on the part of police to take law into its own hands. It did. But then at that, you cannot fault them on motives, and their contribution cannot be denied by any stretch of imagination. The incidents happened years back. Nobody bothered to collect evidence at that point of time. That evidence had disappeared. Some convictions have taken place. But I am talking about a very large number of cases where such evidence is not available. What can you do? You can only acknowledge this fact that this is a weakness in the system and it should be rectified for future.
So you believe that it's acceptable for police officers to operate outside of the law when they're put under different and difficult times?
No, not at all. But I will like that the police people should be so professionally competent that they should be able to deal with it. But this is an utopia. And I will say ultimately, whatever the price one has to pay, it was a very high price. Ultimately, the militancy has been eliminated and we are living a peaceful and hopeful life. We have been able to get back to normalcy. All these things should be now forgotten and we should construct a life for our better future.
Life has now returned to normal in the state. During much of the campaign, Punjab was under direct rule from Delhi. Its own state assembly was suspended. Now democracy has been restored, but opinion is strongly divided on how to deal with the past. Anupam Gupta is a lawyer defending some of the police now on trial and believes rather than being prosecuted, they should be lauded.
The law is truly value blind here. For it's my conviction as a lawyer that the murder of a terrorist is murder only in a physical sense. It should not be treated as a murder in any value-related sense of the term. The inevitable result is the security forces are left with no option but to act against terrorism on the ground, wholly outside the law, and in a manner so as not to be detected by the law.
So what you're basically saying is that the officers who are out there on the ground, they were entitled to have stepped out of the law?
Speaking for myself, yes.
If the police are stepping outside of the law, they're actually acting like the terrorists. They're fighting terror with terror.
I would plead guilty to the charge, conceptually speaking. In very few of these cases, has the CBI gone up and told the court that the deceased was a terrorist and that the police officer who killed him, who is now being prosecuted for murder, killed him not out of for any other reason, but in the interest of protecting the state and the security of the state. Raising that ultimate moral question, which even the judiciary is bound to answer in every land, on whose side are you on?
It's estimated that nearly 1,800 police officers and paramilitaries were killed in the war against the separatists. Dinka Gupta was one of those in the front line.
We had a big massacre of about more than 30 people were killed. They were pulled out of a bus. They were coming back after a day's work and the bus was stopped. They were taken out. And all those who were from outside Punjab, from outside the state, they were made to form up a line and a queue kind of a thing and shot over there. And that was a terrible massacre, actually.
He feels that the police were ill-equipped and ill-trained. And he admits this led to some abuses which can now be acknowledged.
Everybody was so much on the edge that, you know, it was very difficult keeping a sense of balance when you were targeted. It's very easy to make fine distinctions now. Good officers did try to make sure that aberrations were kept at a minimum. I mean, as a police officer, I don't mind even apologizing, actually. I mean, if some people got the rough end of the stick at that point of time.
Now nearly 20 years since the storming of the Golden Temple, the attempt to move on is not easy for those who still wait for justice for their sons, husbands, fathers and brothers. For them, this chapter in Punjab's history isn't yet closed. Until it is, activists like Dr. Jasdev Rai continue to argue that it raises questions about the world's largest democracy and its commitment to human rights.
I do hope that policing methods in India have changing. I do hope this state becomes more conscious of the need for human rights culture within the country. Persecution and oppression is never a method to deal with political dissent or activism. You know, I don't really believe there are ever circumstances in any country, in any region, ever for the state to justify taking action which is unconstitutional, which is outside the normal norms of international standards.